from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, nearing the deadline for an Iran nuclear deal. The WHO appealing for millions of dollars to prop up healthcare in Syria.
As Syria enters fifth year of a conflict, situation is deteriorating.
Considering changes following the crash of the German Wings Airbus. China and Singapore restricting Thailand flights. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Negotiations on curbing Iran's nuclear program entered their final hours today before a self-imposed midnight deadline, with teams from Iran and a group of six world powers trying to resolve 18 months of talks on the outline of a comprehensive agreement. VOA correspondent Al Pessin is in Lausanne, Switzerland.
We're in the final hours here heading towards the deadline, and there's lots of chatter, but I wouldn't say there's anything major. We've had relatively optimistic statements from both the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers who are involved in the talks, but they always caveat it by saying if things continue the way they are or if nothing changes. So there's no guarantee of an agreement. There was an Associated Press report that said officials were drafting a joint statement and a list of points that the negotiators had agreed on. But later there was a Reuters story quoting an official as saying, yes, we're doing that, but we're also preparing statements in case the talks don't work out. So everybody's trying to read the tea leaves and jumping on every little detail. But the fact is that we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Even the negotiators, I am convinced, do not know for sure if they're going to get an agreement. If they do get an agreement, we don't know what form it will take. Will it be a written agreement? Will it be a joint statement? Will it be separate but similar statements? There's just no specific requirement at this stage because this is only an interim step. They're supposed to agree on the broad outlines of the agreement. The political decisions are supposed to have been met and the major elements are supposed to be in line, and then they're going to take three more months to write the detailed agreement, and of course that will be a very difficult process as well. So this is an important juncture, but we don't know what's going to happen, and this is not the end of the process in any case.
Do we know what the stumbling blocks are?
Well, we think we know what the stumbling blocks are. I mean, based on various statements here and there. One thing from the Iranian side, they want sanctions relieved more quickly and more definitively than the other negotiators would like. And on the other side, the negotiators want more transparency. They want Iran to ship its uranium, enriched uranium, out of the country. They want some of its facilities repurposed. They want intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency to ensure that Iran is complying. And they want limits on Iran's development of more sophisticated nuclear technology, at least for several years. So it's very complicated, very technical on the nuclear side as well as on the sanctions side. We have an idea what the sticking points are, but we don't know exactly. And you know, the negotiators are very fond of saying nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And what that means is that even if they have more or less agreed on some points, if they run into a problem on other points, they may go back to those previous points and say, well, if we give a little more on that, will you give us a little more on this? So everything is in play. It's a very complex three-dimensional puzzle, and we just don't know what's going to happen by or around midnight tonight.
Correspondent Al Pessin reporting from Lausanne, Switzerland. A Saudi-led coalition since last Thursday has conducted an aerial bombardment throughout Yemen against Houthi Shiite rebels. After seizing the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, last year, the Houthis have advanced toward the southern port city of Aden, the economic center of the impoverished nation. The insurgents shelled Aden with artillery Monday as they pushed into the northeastern outskirts of the city, while Saudi fighter jets continued to pound rebel positions. The country's current president, Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi, had declared Aden the provisional capital before he fled the country for Riyadh last week. About 100 people have been killed in the fighting in Aden in the last several days, and Mr. Hadi's aide said he has no immediate plans to return there. Scholars who follow the region say while the end game is not clear, Saudi Arabia is clearly worried about the possibility of the Houthis consolidating control over the core of Yemen. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution in Washington tells VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi The Saudis will have to weigh the benefits of a military operation against the inevitable risks.
Mr. Ohanian, could the continued coalition air attacks against Houthis in Yemen risk incite additional unrest, especially with the collateral damage inevitably caused by airstrikes?
Well, there are risks to any policy. This is a war. So I sometimes find it a little counterintuitive that people expect they can find risk-free strategies in war. There is no safe approach here. What we've seen is, of course, a Houthi movement that risks overtaking much or most or even all of Yemen, but more likely creating zones of instability that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula as well as ISIL can take advantage of. So I'm afraid we're in a risky situation whether we like it or not, regardless of what policies might be taken by outside players. There certainly are dangers and possibilities of civilian casualties, and that's part of why I'm glad the United States is helping with intelligence, because even though it risks implicating Washington in any mistakes that might be made, I think we can reduce the chances of dangerous incidents by providing good information on where the strikes should take place. And more generally, I'm not sure the air power strikes will be adequate. So my greater worry is not about the possibility of an occasional civilian casualty, however regrettable that would be. It's more about the basic strategy that's being followed and whether it has a good chance of success.
Well, Saudi and Egyptian officials have alluded to a potential ground intervention. Would that maximize firepower while enabling the coalition to actually seize and hold transfer-occupied grounds to preferred proxies?
I do think that the possibility of ground forces needs to be considered, but one needs to ask what's their ultimate purpose. And if the ultimate purpose is to defeat the Houthis comprehensively, I'm not sure that's a smart strategy. I'm not sure that's going to work. It may be more realistic to think about liberating part of the country, and certainly the southern part, to begin. And then one can ask about Sana'a and whether that should be the ultimate objective. But I don't know that you want to go for a complete defeat of the Houthi, because I think that risks roiling much of the Shia population against the possible intervening forces and exacerbating the civil war. So ground power may be necessary, but I think it probably needs to be carefully circumscribed, at least in the initial effort, and that would be my recommendation.
Final question. Is the military campaign tailored to force Houthis and their allies to go back to the negotiating table or push them back into their traditional territory in the country's north?
Well, I don't know what the goals are of the Saudis and others, and what I'm suggesting is that a negotiation, as well as maybe perhaps a de facto or even official partition of the country, might be the most appropriate goals diplomatically and militarily. But I don't know what's really lurking in the minds of the planners in Riyadh and elsewhere, and they may have other ambitions.
Michael O'Hanlon, thank you very much for being with the Voice of America.
Thank you, sir.
The World Health Organization is appealing for $124 million at the International Humanitarian Pledging Conference for Syria in Kuwait. Tarek Kriasharovich spoke with us from Kuwait about the WHO's recent mission to Syria to assess conditions there.
I'm just coming back from a couple of weeks spent inside Syria. Last week, we went, for example, to Aleppo, a city in the northern part of the country that was very badly affected by this crisis. As soon as we arrived to the city, we have been called to visit local hospital where dozens of injured people were rushed that morning after several mortars landed in the central part of Aleppo. So we could really see the high price civilians are paying in this conflict, but we also saw dedication of health workers, doctors, nurses, and other staff that is really doing their best under difficult circumstances to help those who were injured in that particular instance, but also patients in general.
What is the overall situation in the nation?
When it comes to health situation in Syria, as Syria enters fifth year of a conflict, situation is deteriorating. There are more health centers, more hospitals being put out of function, more ambulances being put out of function. Immunization coverage is getting lower. There is a problem with access to clean water. All this causes number of emerging diseases. People who have chronic diseases also have problems of getting the medicines they need. So basically, there is a combination of elements making that the health situation is getting worse, and we really need to continue to do what we do so we can provide help, provide basic health services to the population. And this is why we really count on this conference in Kuwait to try to raise some funds so we can continue to provide treatments and supporting health system and all health providers in all parts of Syria as we did so far.
It's a very dangerous place, Syria. Are you concerned about your World Health workers?
Well, we are definitely concerned. And I was just telling you about this incident in Aleppo that we were able to witness. One of the victims was accidentally a doctor who worked in this same hospital. It's just a person who happened to be at the right place, at the wrong place at the wrong time. So basically, health workers are equally paying the price. Lack of access to health services is not only for that when patients cannot come to health services that are still functioning, but also health workers who cannot access their working place. So they are the real heroes of this of this conflict, but also paying a high price.
Have you found that the health workers are targets of the violence deliberately?
Well, there were instances where health facilities were deliberately targeted, were used as a military facilities as well. We know that in Syria, around 45% of health workers have left the country, leaving some places with shortage of health workers. So again, what we are trying from our side, from the World Health Organization, we organize frequent trainings for health workers, trying to equip them to deal with a number of different medical conditions that people may have so they can do their job at best. We also really try to support health facilities with equipment, with medical supplies they need. We also try really to help with financial support to vaccination campaigns that we are doing by paying per diems to vaccination teams. So really, our work is helping health workers in Syria, and we hope that donor countries will show their solidarity with us and by that with the health workers inside the country.
Tarek Krijasarovic with the World Health Organization speaking with us from Kuwait. German authorities investigating the March 24th crash of German Wings Airbus A320 en route to Dusseldorf from Barcelona, killing all 150 people on board, say the co-pilot, suspected of deliberately crashing the plane into the French Alps, had suicidal tendencies. Prosecutors say 27-year-old Andreas Lubitz suffered bouts of depression and anxiety and was receiving psychotherapy while earning his pilot's license. Parent company Lufthansa certified him to fly in 2013. A motive behind the crash remains elusive. Investigators say an evolution of the recovered cockpit voice recorder alleges Lubitz locked the pilot outside of the cockpit before slamming the plane into a French mountainside. That has prompted some airlines to mandate the presence of at least two people in the cockpit at all times. The website airsafe.com has provided aviation security information to the flying public as well as the airline industry since 1996. Founder Todd Curtis told VOA's Victor Beatty, requiring two people in the cockpit will help eliminate a repeat of last week's tragedy.
That scenario won't exist, but certainly if there is someone in the cockpit who might be, let's say, a flight attendant, who may not be as sophisticated with trying to wrestle control from the aircraft, if the person wanted to lock the cabin door and either try and subdue the second person or start manipulating the controls, whatever their opinion may have been about it, someone who is not a pilot may not be in a position to counteract someone who has an intent to wreck the aircraft. It will be very, very beneficial to have a second person in the unlikely event of some sort of medical emergency happening. Heart attack, stroke, where the person is incapacitated, it may accidentally or in their delusion lock the cabin door and maybe pass out. That scenario, having two people in the cockpit, that's a good idea. But will it prevent what happened last week? In my opinion, if someone intends to crash the airplane, they can do so whether or not there's someone else in the cockpit or not. Should something be done in the wake of what happened in France? I think public sentiment is overwhelming that something should be done now, not necessarily saying it should be a permanent change, but something should be done to address this issue and as soon as possible. So I believe the public's fear has been allayed greatly by the industry pretty much universally taking steps in that direction.
Do you anticipate any changes by domestic and international aviation authorities and by the air carriers themselves with regard to who actually sits in the cockpit?
I suspect there may be changes, but they won't be done in the short term. Any changes like that would imply there would have to be a change in not only the screening of candidates and the training of candidates. There would have to be, in my opinion, also changes in the laws and the regulations that are relevant when it comes to who can and cannot fly.
Do you see an irony post 9/11 in sealing the cockpit from the rest of the passengers that the pilot was locked out and found it impossible to get in before the plane crashed? And what could be done about that?
Any system, any set of procedures, any protective barrier that one erects in order to prevent a certain kind of risk usually means that there's a trade-off. Reduction of one risk may mean an increase in other risk or the creation of brand new risk. Well, that's one thing. On the other hand, I can say this. The issue of pilots taking command of an aircraft and deliberately crashing it or trying to crash it existed before the rules of 9/11. In fact, in a brief bit of research I did after the events in France, I looked for events since 1980 where an airline pilot is either suspected to have or was proven to have deliberately crashed an aircraft. And there were 7 cases, including France, where that was true. And an 8th case, which happened to be a FedEx aircraft in the U.S. in 1994, where an off-duty pilot tried to commandeer an aircraft from the 3 on-duty pilots, and the 3 pilots were barely able to fight this man off and land the airplane safely. So whether or not you had these protective barriers for 9/11, the same underlying problem exists. There are a small number of pilots out there who, for whatever reason, may one day decide to put the entire aircraft and everyone else at risk who was on that aircraft. The big question is, how do you find out this risk before it manifests itself? And how do you deal with it once it happens in the sky?
Curtis says, given the tens of thousands of aircraft operating worldwide, any changes to the cockpit will likely take years to implement unless aviation authorities mandate immediate alterations. He says air travel remains among the safest modes of transportation, with only a handful of fatal events each year. However, in the case of the German Wings crash and the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 in March of last year, he says the public's perception of safety is impacted by the amount of media attention given to each event. Curtis says the deliberate crash of Mozambican Airlines flight TM470 in November of 2013 by the pilot received scant coverage. China and Singapore have joined Japan and South Korea in restricting flights by Thailand's airlines as the kingdom scrambles to address significant safety concerns by the UN's International Civil Aviation Organization. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
The ICAO tells VOA that an audit of Thailand revealed some safety concerns, primarily relating to air operator certification procedures. That was enough to prompt several countries to begin blocking new and charter flights from Thailand. The Director General of Thailand's Department of Civil Aviation, Somchai Piputvat, tells VOA the shortcomings in the ICAO audit involve regulatory issues, not safety problems at airlines.
To fly the carrier based in Thailand.
But industry sources say the most serious concerns involve shortcomings for safety regulations for low-cost carriers, including certifications for air operations and the transportation of hazardous goods. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha says Thailand needs to take responsibility for the rules violations and fix the problem. The former army chief, who seized power in a military coup last May, vows to utilize Section 44 of the interim charter to rectify the problems of Thailand's airlines. That section effectively allows the junta boss to issue any orders he deems appropriate, without judicial or other oversight. There is concern more countries, including the United States, will take similar action, especially if the ICAO downgrades Thailand from Category 1 to Category 2. A U.S. government source, who is not authorized to speak on the record, explained the ICAO report would probably trigger an audit of Thailand's aviation sector by the Federal Aviation Administration. He calls the ICAO audit results a real red flag for the FAA. Thailand government officials are blaming politicians of previous administrations for not concentrating on the problem. The ICAO has rejected the Civil Aviation Department's enhancement plan submitted March 2nd, reportedly because it proposed a two-year period to fix problems. Thailand plans to submit on April 7th a revised proposal, promising to solve the issue within 8 months. Critics have said Thailand's civil aviation sector suffers from frequent changes of government, corruption, complacency, and incompetence. On professional pilots forums on the internet, industry workers allege Thai government inspectors were bribed with cash and massages to favorably sign off on paperwork. Civil Aviation Department Director General Somchai tells VOA that no such allegations have yet come to his attention.
It's the goal of the government and my policy that no corruption will occur in Thailand or in Department of Civil Aviation. I will look for this really carefully and immediately.
Currently operated flights have not been affected by the ICAO audit. But the loss of new and charter flights during the April-May high tourist season reportedly will affect more than 150,000 passengers. Travel operators say this has caused the price of some package tours during the Songkran holiday to nearly double. Other than the kingdom's flag carrier, Thai Airways International, the ICAO safety warning is also affecting low-cost carriers. Thai Air Asia X, Nok Scoot, Orient Thai, Skyview, and Asia Atlantic Airlines. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ballots are being counted in Nigeria following a largely peaceful and orderly weekend vote in national elections. Millions of voters turned out and waited patiently for hours March 28th to let their voices be heard, despite technical glitches, some confusion, and isolated attacks by the terrorist group Boko Haram. Approximately 300 of some 120,000 polling stations reopened the next day to complete the process. Whoever the voters have chosen as Nigeria's next president, the incumbent, Goodluck Jonathan, or former head of state, Muhammadu Buhari, will help set the future course of Africa's most populous country and leading economy. The United States is committed to working with the next democratically elected government of Nigeria that results from this vote. It is critically important that all parties remain calm and not resort to violence as the results are tabulated and reported. Post-election violence in 2011 left more than 800 people dead across the country. President Jonathan and General Buhari made public pledges to condemn election-related violence, and they reaffirmed those commitments in a second peace accord March 26th. The United States welcomes the vote and the respect shown in it for democratic principles. The Nigerian people have shown a commendable determination to register their vote and choose their leaders. Even without evidence of systemic manipulation of the process so far, observers have noted indications that the collation process, where the votes are finally counted, may be subject to deliberate political interference. This would contravene the letter and spirit of the Abuja Accord, to which both major parties committed themselves. The government of the United States would be very concerned by any attempts to interfere with the electoral process or to undermine the independence of the Electoral Commission or its chairman, or in any way distort the expressed will of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.